Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Blast on the Progressive Radio Network. It is NBL on PRN.FM. This July 14, 2015, episode number 46 of Nature Bats Blast comes live from Guy at the Mud Hut, as well as me from Ocean Beach, California. So if you hear an occasional airplane, I apologize since I'm apparently in the flight pattern for the San Diego airport. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Afrozen, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. We're going to start with Guy. He received an interesting message the other day, and he's going to share it with us. Guy?
First, a little context. I'm routinely accused of making people depressed by revealing evidence. People my age and older particularly take issue with me revealing evidence to youngsters. Never mind the Santa Claus approach preferred by the dominant culture. I'll focus instead on the facts. I receive messages quite frequently from people in their teens and 20s. The demographic reading the blog is dominated by people under the age of 34 years. One exemplary message came to me via Facebook from 26-year-old Tommy Tipton 2 days ago. Quote, I just had to say, you've been a huge factor in all the positive changes in my life in the past 3 to 4 years. Oddly enough, thoroughly looking at it and accepting this information has only helped me. It's had the opposite effect than one might think. I quit drinking about 3 years ago. I quit cigarettes, although I fell back for a bit. Ha ha. The last thing I want to do is piss away the time I have. It should always be quality over quantity, but recently it's been pushed to the forefront of my life, and that's a gift. I have hobbies that I love now. I have motivation like never before. Everything tastes a little sweeter over here. Thanks again to you and Pauline for helping me to realize what's important and why. I've never been happier. Even if we're all wrong, what bad changes have I made? None. So either way, I come out on top, in my opinion. A lot of people don't live to see 35 to 40. A lot of beings never even see 20. So I consider myself disappointed in no way at all. In my experience, a lot of people prefer reality over fantasy. I'm sure she meant to include you, Mike, there too. Thanks for providing this recent example, Tommy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems like every once in a while, it kind of dawns on some of us that, hey, this is an opportunity to maybe refocus some things in our lives. And, you know, because no one here, like we always say, no one here gets out alive regardless, whether or not you believe in climate change or not. So it's good to hear things like that.
Yes, it is. Nice validation, at least, for the work we're doing.
Absolutely. Well, today our guest is Robert Jensen. Robert Jensen is a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. Jensen joined the UT faculty in 1992 after completing his PhD in media ethics and law in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. Prior to his academic career, he worked as a professional journalist for a decade. At UT, Jensen teaches courses in media, law, ethics, and politics. In his research, Jensen draws from a variety of critical approaches on media to media and power. Much of his work is focused on pornography and the radical feminist critique of sexuality and men's violence. And he has also addressed questions of race through a critique of white privilege and institutional racism. In addition to teaching and research, Jensen writes for popular media, both alternative and mainstream. His opinion and analytic pieces on such subjects as foreign policy, politics, and race have appeared in papers around the country. He contributes to local organizing in Austin, Texas, through his work with the Third Coast Activist Resource Center. Jensen is the author of Playing Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue, All of My Bones Shake, Seeking a Progressive Path to Prophetic Voice, Getting Off, Pornography and the End of Masculinity, The Heart of Whiteness, one of my favorites, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege, Citizens of Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity and Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream. Jensen is also a co-producer of the documentary film Abe Asheroff, One Foot in the Grave and the Other Still Dancing, which chronicles the life and philosophy of longtime radical activists. Jensen was a consultant for the filmmakers of the 2008 documentary The Price of Pleasure, Pornography, Sexuality, and Relationships, in which he also was interviewed. He is also the co-writer, producer of an educational slideshow in PowerPoint about pornography, Who Wants to Be a Porn Star? Sex and Violence in Today's Pornography Industry. Robert's articles can be found online at robertwjensen.org. Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, Robert Jensen.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
And dare I say, happy birthday?
You can say it. I can't deny reality. I am 57 years old.
57.
Facebook told me, so it must be true.
Yes, yeah. that's where I found it.
I always point out I share a birthday with Woody Guthrie. So, company.
Good company. Excellent. I was first introduced to your work at the White Privilege Conference in St. Louis about 9 years ago, and I remember a colleague of mine and myself were sitting at a table in a room with you and amongst other people, and we had a conversation which you referred to the three Holocausts perpetuated in U.S. history, and you talked about these Holocausts in some detail, and I was wondering if we could start there, and maybe you can talk about the three Holocausts that most people don't recognize in American history and what impact they've had on the larger culture today.
Yeah, I think that one of the problems in the modern world is that we don't name honestly and accurately the phenomenon of the world, especially in the United States, the most, affluent country in the history of the world, and especially in the universities, where I think people often get paid to obscure reality, not to reveal it.
Right.
So I tend to talk bluntly. And as you point out, I've used this idea that there have been three what I would call racialized Holocausts in U.S. history. The first and foundational one was the genocidal conquest of the continent, the almost complete extermination of indigenous people, without which there would be no United States. In recorded human history, there's nothing like that particular Holocaust. The second Holocaust, and I use that term, again, not hyperbolically, but I think quite clearly and accurately, the second Holocaust would be African slavery. Again, millions of people killed, entire cultures destroyed to provide the labor that produced the cotton that helped propel the United States into the industrial world. So there would be no United States, and the United States would not be the wealthiest country in the history of the world without these two foundational racialized Holocausts. The third Holocaust I talk about is the post-World War II imposition of American power, both economic and military, around the world. Also racialized in the sense that most of the targets of that, whether we're talking about Latin America or Southern Africa, Southeast Asia, the Middle East, most of the targets of this violence of the United States have been non-white people. And it's always easier to marshal support in a white-defined nation like the United States if your targets are non-white.
Right.
And once again, in that post-World War II era, we're talking about millions of human lives destroyed to secure this affluence of the United States. So many people find that a rather harsh way to describe U.S. history, but I think if we were honest, that's the way to talk about that kind of brutality. And then to always remind ourselves that we wouldn't be sitting here with this level of affluence. Obviously, not everyone in the United States is affluent in the sense of, the top 1%.
Right.
but it's an affluent nation across the board. And without that violence, that affluence would not exist.
I mean, it seems to me, and what you did for me, at least, you know, back when I first started following your work, is you had the ability to make connections between what I thought, you know, were different things, in mentioning these Holocausts. And I was wondering the importance of that, of making those connections, because it seems to me that we compartmentalize everything as far as our history goes. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about making those connections for people and why it's important.
Absolutely. And here again, let's beat up on the modern American university. anybody mind if I beat up on the modern American university?
I know, Guy will not
please
mind.
Let yourself go here.
Yeah. So, you know, what is a liberal education about? And I use liberal not in the, you know, narrow political sense, but in the mm-hmm. sense of a broad, open, enlightenment education. Well, it should be about making those connections. But in my lifetime, let's just take my life in academia, which is about going on three decades now. The rewards in academia are for not only specialization, but hyper-specialization. And the best and most fruitful paths are to avoid those kinds of connections that you're talking about. And in fact, it's very rare to find an academic who makes those kinds of sweeping connections. You win a Nobel Prize for a very specific kind of work.
Right.
Now, obviously, there are people who are holdouts. You know, in some sense, the best people making those connections are the ecologists, the people whose, in fact, whole reason for being is, you know, the connections, seeing things as interaction. And a lot of those ecologists not only stick to the biological, but of course make connections to the social, the political, the economic. So the modern academy gives us the freedom to do this kind of work, although it doesn't necessarily reward it very well. And, you know, I always say one of the secrets to my success, to the degree I had success, and I am a professor at a major university and I get paid well. So to the degree I've had success, it's because I'm mediocre and I know it. That is to say, I'm not a cutting edge thinker. I'm well aware that I'm not going to make, you know, really innovative progress on particular disciplines. But I am able to synthesize, and I was trained to write as a journalist, and I think I write fairly clearly. So it seemed to me that given the particular privileges and abilities I have, it only made sense to try and tell the stories we're talking about in that bigger context. And I've been very grateful to have that opportunity.
That's an excellent viewpoint. I realized many years ago that I would never make the New York Times obituary page based on my accomplishments. So I thought I would have to die in a really weird way just so I could make the New York Times. Maybe that's not an appropriate goal for me now that I think about it.
Let's hope that obituary isn't for tomorrow's paper. Let's at least get through this interview. But, you know, I was thinking, I had a colleague here at the University of Texas in the biology department who, you know, came up in a pretty standard way, but developed an interest in land management, especially in ranching. He was interested in, you know, basically in ecology. And the University of Texas really could never figure out what to do with him. He was actually doing some innovative work. He was working with ranchers. He was trying to take the knowledge that's generated in the university and put it to use, not to generate profits or to, you know, patent something new, but to figure out how do we manage ranches in a way that is more ecologically sustainable. Now, from my point of view, he should have been, you know, at the head of the pack. He should have been the person who was getting the awards and the rewards, because you want to, you know, create incentives for that kind of work. But in fact, he was really kind of a cast off here, which is a shame, because I think there are a lot of people who come into intellectual life. And I'm using that term intellectual life, not in any haughty or elitist sense, but that curiosity that makes us want to understand how the world works. People come into intellectual life often because they want to make the world a better place. They see problems, and more of those problems are foundational ecological crises. But they find that the rewards are not in pursuing that kind of knowledge. And that's what we have to, you know, work hard to protect when people do want to do it.
Yeah, that's great. I'd like to continue the thread of liberalism, connecting dots, and the intellectual life found on university campuses. As I understand the situation, no industrialized society is less media savvy than this one. If that's accurate, can you explain why that might be?
Well, you know, many people have pointed out, I remember the first time I heard this was from Noam Chomsky, that propaganda and the sophisticated use of media to try and shape the way we think is most effective when people think they're living in a free society. You know, people have often pointed out that citizens of the old Soviet Union, you know, or, you know, similar totalitarian societies often were well aware that the information being presented to them, especially by the government, was pure propaganda. Nobody took it to be meaningful interaction through media. Well, in a free society, we're conditioned and socialized to believe that, in fact, it is a free media. And therefore, when we turn on the news, we're not watching propaganda. We're watching professional journalism produced under conditions of relative freedom. Well, I've worked in journalism, and to some degree, that's true. Journalists do operate with a fair amount of freedom in this country, at least freedom from overt government interference. But lots of other forces shape the way the news is collected and presented, of course. And that's where I think we lack the kind of media savvy or media literacy that you're talking about. We don't realize that no information is ever presented in a condition of complete freedom. And so what's really important is to understand the forces that shape our media. You could make the same claim about education, of course. What are the forces that shape education? All of these, you know, interactions between people in schools and universities in media settings have the potential to be forums for real dialogue, real democratic engagement, but only if we're aware of power. And one of the things that this society does very well is obscure the realities of power and how it operates. So part of any decent liberal education is education into how power works. But of course, there's a paradox there, because the people paying you to be a teacher, be a professor, be a journalist typically have an interest in making sure people don't understand that power. But it's an open system. I mean, we're sitting here talking. I'm still a professor at the University of Texas. So we don't live in a totalitarian society. That's important to recognize. But only if we can see the more subtle forces that shape the world we live in.
Sure. In fact, the mainstream media have been largely taken over by a few corporations during our lifetimes. And I would say that takeover as an expression of power has accelerated within the last three decades. Can you describe the trend and talk about some of the consequences?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, when we talk about the increasing corporate concentration of ownership in the media, it's important not to pretend there was some golden age when, you know, family-owned newspapers were the norm and everybody had, you know, access to free and open information. Whenever you have a commercial media system, that is, whenever the media system is dominated by for-profit corporations, there are going to be forces that shape and limit the news. Those forces have been at play in the United States for a long time. The story of the development of the media system in the United States is actually much more complicated, going back to colonial times when media didn't pretend to be objective and were not really a commercial enterprise. They were political media that were often owned and operated by people with very specific political agendas. But in the contemporary period, the 20th century, let's say, this concentration of corporate ownership has had generally negative effects. For instance, it's focused media managers much more on short-term profit. So instead of thinking about media as a public service that has to make a profit, the public service aspect quickly evaporates, and it's all about the bottom line, not only over the long term, but in this quarter. That leads to, you know, reducing newsroom staff. All of this took place before the digital revolution that challenged the business model of advertising supporting media. So a lot of people in the media want to say that all of our problems are a result of the internet. But these are problems, as you point out, that began long before. The concentration of corporate ownership has been intensifying for the last 40 years. Ben Bagdikian, who wrote the original book, The Media Monopoly, based on data from the 1970s, has charted that reduction of the number of corporations that really hold real power. And right now we're talking really about a half a dozen journalism and media corporations that control the flow of information into most of the homes in the United States.
So, I mean, we can go ahead, Guy. Do you have something?
Yeah, just another follow-up. Sorry to carve into your time, Mike, but I can't help myself. One of the premises underlying Derek Jensen's book, Endgame, is that all writing is propaganda. You mentioned that Soviet citizens recognized Pravda as propaganda, but we tend to not think, in this country, we tend to not think of the information put out by the mainstream as being propaganda. We tend to think of that as objective, unbiased news. Can you comment?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I want to hold on to the idea that there can be human communication that is not simply propaganda. Part of this is just definitional. We live in a democracy. A democracy is based on the notion of the distribution of political power, the informed consent of the citizenry, all of these kind of ideas. That means there has to be space for what I would call democratic dialogue. Now, are there rules that democratic dialogue can go forward on that mean we're not always simply reducing our communication to propaganda? I want to hold on to the idea that there is. There can be, for instance, rules about the openness of the process. In a propaganda system, the process is closed. Most people don't have access to the means of communication. In a system that strives for democratic dialogue, you'd have a basic proposition about openness, that everybody has a right to enter the conversation and actually has access to and the resources to do that. So we clearly don't live in a totalitarian system in the United States, but we also just as clearly don't live in a system that produces that kind of free and open dialogue in a meaningful way. So we struggle to maximize that kind of space. But I think you're absolutely right. We should always be aware that most of the communication coming to us has an interest, and that interest is almost always in the mainstream media, in the interest of power. When we look at commercial advertising, if you turn on the TV and see an advertisement for a product, we know quite clearly that's propaganda. It might affect our buying patterns, because propaganda can affect us even if we're aware of it. But as you're pointing out, much more dangerous is the propaganda we don't recognize. And that's a constant struggle to both educate others and to be aware yourself that propaganda is coming at you from all sides.
You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network with our guest, Robert Jensen, University of Texas journalism professor, author, and activist. Robert, you wrote an article recently, American Journalism Ideology, Why Liberal Media is Fundamentalist, and it was a response to a U.S. news media organization. I was wondering if you could talk about some of the elements of the dominant ideology of the contemporary United States, and then maybe touch upon whether or not you believe there's a dominant ideology in the industrial civilized culture as well.
Yeah. You know, we're always fretting about the effects of religious fundamentalism, and I think religious fundamentalism is dangerous. I'm not a fundamentalist. Anytime people are claiming to have a kind of inside track on ultimate truth, there are reasons to be nervous. But there are other fundamentalisms beyond religion. So in that piece, I talk about the other three fundamentalisms that tend to be at work in American media and American culture more generally. One is what I would call national fundamentalism, this belief in the ultimate righteousness of the United States, this commonly held belief that the United States is distinct among nations. Sometimes this is called American exceptionalism, the idea that we have a special place in the history of the world.
Right.
That national fundamentalism is common in the United States politically, and you see it in the media. There's also an economic fundamentalism, a belief in the kind of ultimate rationality of capitalism, the belief that capitalism is not just one among many potential economic systems, but in fact the only sane and rational system. You see that, of course, in American politics, and you see it in the media. These are fundamentalisms that are kind of reflexive. Journalists, in the context of media, journalists don't really even question them. But as you point out, there's a far deeper fundamentalism in some sense. And that's the fundamentalism of the industrial world, the belief that this high-energy, high-technology system is, the way to go. This is what many people refer to as a kind of technological fundamentalism, the belief that any human problems can be solved by the application of more high-energy, high-technology. And what's so ironic is the people who hold this position believe that even the problems caused by previous applications of high energy, high technology can be solved by what? Well, by more high energy, high technology.
Right.
Probably the most insane aspect of this technological fundamentalism is what's being referred to as geoengineering. So high energy, high technology has created climate change, which now threatens not only the human species, but life on the planet as we know it. So what's the solution to climate change? Well, to some people, it's these fantasy scenarios about, spreading particles in the sky to reflect sunlight. Literally, human attempts through technology to alter the climate system. To me, that's probably the ultimate evidence that we live in a lunatic society, that these ideas are taken seriously. And of course, they are being taken seriously. A whole lot of people say, well, if climate change is real and we're not going to stop it by recognizing the need to limit our consumption, especially our consumption of fossil fuels, well, then let's just play God to the nth degree and play around with the upper atmosphere and maybe we'll fix it, or maybe we'll destroy the planet completely. This is the state of the contemporary world. And the geoengineering fanatics are, in a sense, just the most outrageous example.
Yeah.
Because most of society, including people who acknowledge the reality of climate change, are willing to accept, other kinds of technological fundamentalism, the belief that somehow we're going to invent our way out of problems that are really a question of human nature. Human beings we're biological entities, and we have gotten very good at scrambling to exploit the energy of the planet. And the question is, can we impose limits on ourselves? And the technological fundamentalism promises that there are no limits, and that's why it's so dangerous.
Yeah, otherwise, we'll just send Matthew McConaughey in a spaceship to find Earth 2. It seems like we negotiate or continue to negotiate with, the non-negotiable. And geoengineering seems to be the almost the pinnacle of that to me.
Yeah, and that's why, the name of your show sums it up so well. Yeah. Nature bats last. I remember I first heard that phrase some years ago, and it immediately clarified the nature of the problem.
Right, right.
We're used to negotiating, and that's why contemporary politics is so inadequate to this. The Americans negotiate with the Russians, nation states sit down and negotiate, labor unions negotiate with employers. Yeah. But as you're pointing out, nature doesn't negotiate. The biophysical limits of the planet are not open to negotiation. And we have a hard time, apparently, taking that seriously, because when you listen to mainstream politicians talk about this, what they really are talking about in some ways is that the biophysical limits of the planet are somehow negotiable, and they're not. And until we can come to terms with that, there isn't a lot of hope for the future, it seems to me.
Well, right, and most of the fantasy technology folks ignore the work by Tim Garrett particularly, and there's been some follow-up research as well, that civilization itself is a heat engine. That it doesn't really matter if we use solar panels and wind turbines and so-called alternatives, which are really derivatives of fossil fuels. It's civilization itself that keeps the heat going with respect to climate change, and also that continues the onslaught in the sixth great extinction.
Yeah, and I think it's important to recognize we're not just talking about climate change. Climate change is the most dramatic and, in some sense, threatening ecological crisis we face. But we're talking about problems across the board. We're talking about soil erosion. We're talking about groundwater contamination. We're talking about changes in the hydrological cycle. We're talking about the dead zones in the Gulf. We're talking about, you know, garden variety pollution. God, I remember, I'm old enough to remember when, you know, the biggest problem seemed to be what we called pollution. Right. That there might be a couple of places nearby that were, you know, full of toxic waste, or the air in, above Los Angeles was too fog or smoggy. You know, there was a river down the road that was dirty. You know, those were what we thought of as problems of pollution, and they were problems we could imagine managing. But, you know, the evidence is piling up pretty quickly that we're not talking about, you know, discrete problems in discrete locations. We're talking about a global crisis. It's what my friend Jim Coplin, who's the subject of this next book I'm going to publish, used to call multiple cascading ecological crises.
Right.
And crises, plural. We're not talking about a specific problem. We're talking about many. They're multiple crises, and they're cascading. He pointed out long ago that, you know, these are things that don't, that it's not a linear process. You can't predict tipping points. You can't predict how they'll affect the future in certain ways. So, you know, this friend of mine is a very wise man. And when I first met him in the late 80s, long before this was common parlance, he had already, for the better part of a decade, been thinking through this on his own and come to the conclusion, basically, that, you know, the goal wasn't to figure out how to fix all this, that there was too much water under the bridge at this point. And hence, I use this in the subtitle of the book, he said somewhat playfully, although there was a way in which he meant it, he said, the last task of the human species is to learn to leave the planet gracefully. Now, he didn't mean that we should all go throw ourselves over a cliff in some sort of mass suicide.
Right.
He meant that the real task for human beings was to adopt what you might call a more graceful way of living, a more elegant way of living, a way of living that recognized the biophysical limits of the planet and that constructed a decent human community within those limits. He was an interesting fellow because he was born and raised on a farm in central Minnesota at a period before fossil fuels had completely changed that landscape.
Right, right.
Again, that's not to romanticize, you know, pre-oil and gas farming. There were lots of problems. There have been lots of problems with farming as long as human beings have been farming, obviously. But someone with the roots in that older tradition could see that there were other ways of living that weren't powered by coal, oil, and natural gas in the way that modern living is. And I learned a lot from someone who could both look back to those traditions, yet also take the best of modern science to make sense of what was really happening on the ground around us.
Yeah, it's very interesting because most people I talk to, they only know this living arrangement that we live in, and to bring up anything else is utterly ridiculous to them. It's almost like I'm a crazy person when I talk about this, that, you know, how else will we live? And, you know, most people say something like, off the cuff, well, wait, should we just go live back in caves or something like that? But that's because this is all they know.
Yeah.
This is all we know, right? Yeah.
Well, I want to point out, you may be crazy. I don't want to make a judgment.
I could be.
But on this particular criteria, I don't think you are. You know, there's a famous line on the left from a left literary critic where he said it's easier to imagine the end of humanity than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. Mm-hmm. That we've become so accepting of capitalism that we're more likely to believe that we're all going to die before capitalism could be changed.
Yeah.
And I quipped once that it may not only be that it's easier to imagine the end of humanity before the end of capitalism, but it's getting increasingly impossible to imagine the end of air conditioning for most people. That if you say to people, well, you're not going to have air conditioning anymore, they're likely to throw up their hands and say, well, what's the point of living then?
Or the internet.
Of course, you're pointing out that there is a perfectly sane and healthy life without some of these. You know, a friend of mine, Stan Cox, who's a plant breeder at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, great guy, and he wrote a great book called Losing Our Cool, where he pointed out all of the many ways it's quite possible to live without air conditioning.
Yeah.
And his point was to make this larger argument about the nature of a high-energy world. So part of this, I think you're pointing at, is a kind of profound failure of the imagination. You know, people like us are often accused of having no imagination. I don't know if you get that, but I certainly do. People say, well, you just have to imagine a better future.
Yeah.
And I can imagine a better future. I think it's the modern industrial world that lacks the imagination of how we could live without the dense energy of fossil fuel.
Yeah, I think not only lacking of imagination, but also coming to terms with the reality and the emotions that come with that. And Guy read a piece from somebody who was in their 20s at the beginning of the show, and you know, coming to this realization and dealing with the emotions. And you wrote a piece in Yes Magazine, Get Apocalyptic, Why Radical is the New Normal, and you talk about confronting the emotions that the dominant culture brings to the surface for many of us. And I was wondering if you could kind of expand upon that.
Yeah, that was a very moving letter that you read, Guy, and I appreciate it. And I've had that experience myself. I've been writing more and more about this. Again, not from the point of view as a scientist, not as a specialist. I claim no expertise in any of the relevant scientific endeavors here, but simply as a layperson who, you know, is educated and has the time to read widely, I've come to these conclusions, and I've tried to talk about them as bluntly as possible. And I have a steady stream of younger people who come into my office at the University of Texas, sometimes first-year students, 18 years old, straight from the suburbs of Dallas and Houston. And they're searching for the kind of conversation we're having here today. You know, they grew up around this kind of affluence and this energy, but they at some level knew that the answers the dominant culture were offering were not satisfactory. And instead of being depressed by this conversation, I think it's absolutely true that many people kind of come to life when they realize that what they've been struggling with by themselves, and I hear this over and over again, people say, I'm so glad that I read what you wrote or heard your talk, because I've been thinking a lot of this myself. I just thought I was the only person who was thinking. And you know, when you're struggling against the dominant culture in isolation, it's pretty hard to stay sane. So this idea that there are other ways of living that don't require us to capitulate to the industrial model, that there's not a way to preserve a planet for 7 billion people with air conditioning, but there are ways to maintain a planet with a human presence in which human beings could live a good life. You know, people are eager to think about that. I'm not saying this is the majority point of view. I'm not saying that right. If you go to the local shopping mall, you're going to get a consensus on these things, obviously. But at least in my experience, more and more people are eager for this kind of conversation. The article you mentioned, I gave the title, you know, to Getting Apocalyptic, not to, you know, reference the typical religious use of that term, but to recognize in some sense that we're coming to a new awareness, which is what the term apocalypse means. It doesn't mean the end of the world. The word apocalypse from the Greek actually means a coming into clarity, a new understanding. And that's, I think, the deeper meaning of the term, a recognition that the world in which we live, the social systems, the politics, the economics, that is coming to an end.
Yeah.
The planet isn't going to magically, you know, blow up tomorrow. The world isn't going to end, but the way we live in the world is going to have to end. And I think more and more people recognize that, and the kind of conversation that you're having on this show on a regular basis is more and more intriguing and engaging for more people.
Yeah, I think people they seem to miss the connection that we are not the world. And maybe that's part of the issue, is they can't separate the world from not humanity, because there's different aspects to humanity. There's not everybody's living this way, but really just from the industrial culture itself. The industrial culture, to many folks, is the world.
Yeah. Well, take an average student who comes to my classroom at the age of 18, who grew up in a fairly affluent world. Again, we have lots of students from the suburbs of Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, other major cities. And think about the experience they've likely had. It's likely a life which had very limited contact with what we tend to call nature, what I would call simply the living world. You know, maybe you went to scout camp for a week when you were a kid in the summer. But that kind of deep engagement with the larger living world, again, the kind of engagement that my friend Jim Coplin, whom I'm writing about in this book, you know, the book I called Plain Radical because Jim had very radical ideas about politics and economics, but he was a very plain person, and that plainness came from having engaged this larger living world as a child, growing up in rural Minnesota where you didn't go to the park to play. You went out in the woods. You didn't go to the swimming pool for a little recreation. You went to the lake nearby. Now, again, I don't want to romanticize this or make it sound like, oh, well, this is some kind of Eden. But that's a different way of engaging the world. Most of the young people I know have almost no contact with the living world in the way that my friend Jim did. I certainly, growing up in, you know, a small city in North Dakota, had very little contact. And the modern, you know, high-energy suburban world is almost completely detached from this. This is what some people have called, you know, nature deficit disorder. Entire generations growing up with no understanding of what it means to be part of a living world. And to me, that's extremely frightening, because that's, as you're pointing out, a world that doesn't know what it's missing, and therefore a world that can't imagine what it could become.
Absolutely. Oh, you mentioned your book several times, and you've kind of gone into it. When does it come out?
The book will be out in October from Counterpoint, which is a great press out in California that has published the poetry of Gary Snyder and Wendell Berry. So I was especially happy to see the book land at Counterpoint. But it's really just my attempt to talk about the very difficult issues we're engaging right here.
Okay.
Questions about ecological crises, questions about economic crises, questions about the deep patriarchal and white supremacist nature of this society. But talk about them in a positive way in the life of my friend, who was the most radical person I have ever known and willing to engage all of these. He was willing to sort of, in a sense, stare down the worst of what it meant to be human, and in part because he had these roots in a larger living world that made him realize that we were not just the worst of our nature that gets, you know, sort of exacerbated in contemporary society.
Right.
And so I'm trying to address these issues, but through a story about one person, and a person I found, always did find during his life, very inspiring. But, you know, just a plain old Minnesota farm boy.
Sure. But it sounds like you learned a great deal from him.
Yeah, I wouldn't be the person I am today without him. And the other reason for writing the book after his death was to honor that. You know, Jim was always very politically engaged. He was a person who gave a lot of his time and energy to community organizations, to political movements. But he wasn't famous. He wasn't the guy up front. He wasn't the person writing the articles or making the speeches. And another reason I wanted to write was to honor the people who do the real work behind the scenes that keep decent human communities together, that keep political movements going forward. You know, I'm a loudmouth. I like to write and I like to talk. And I've always been well aware that what makes it possible for me to write and talk is the work of people like Jim. That's sometimes really just the hard work of, you know, keeping a community garden going.
Right.
But it's also the intellectual work of being honest and brave enough to face these difficult questions. And my friend Jim Coplin did that better than anybody I know personally.
Well, we look forward to it. And could you tell us the title again?
The title is Plain Radical, and the subtitle really, I think, sums up Jim's life: living, loving, and learning to leave the planet gracefully.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, he not only talked about the human task of being more graceful, but he also, in a very personal way, left the planet gracefully himself and left a legacy that many of his friends we really still rely on Jim's memory as a kind of a model of what it means to be a decent person trying to help sustain decent human communities.
Excellent. We look forward to reading it. We have about a minute left here with you. What's coming up for you?
Well, it's funny. The next book I'm working on this summer is a book on patriarchy. And some people think that my interests in feminist work are somehow a little divorced from my interests in these ecological questions. But I think when we go back to the beginning of the human break with nature, which from my point of view and many others comes with agriculture about 10,000 years ago, that's also where we see the rise of patriarchy. The idea that men can own women came about the same time that people began to believe they could own the earth. And that whole idea that we humans can own other people or actually own the larger living world is profoundly destructive and I think at the heart of our problems. So I'm really eager to think a little more deeply about our history, which is about the destruction of the world and in some ways the destruction of those human bonds that could make decent human communities possible.
Excellent. Well, I've learned a great deal from you over the years, and I look forward to reading more from you and hearing more from you. So thank you for being on the show. It was an honor.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Great conversation, and keep up the good work. Thanks so much for all you're doing.
Absolutely. Thank you. That was Robert Jensen, journalist, professor at the University of Texas, author, and activist. And you can find his articles at robertwjensen.org. Guy, what do you got for us next?
I have a climate summary, and it's quite extensive this week. Woo-hoo! First of all, rapid ice melt in the Arctic region is explained as a product of warm air advection, air mass transformation, and fog in the June 2015 issue of Geophysical Research Letters. That's a lot to swallow. I'm not going to go into any details. All the details can be found at the long, often updated climate change summary and update on the blog. Second piece from the journal literature, while adhering to the impossible to achieve and nonsensical political target of 2 degrees Celsius, a paper in the July 3rd, 2015 issue of Science points out that, quote, as far down as 700 meters, the water temperatures have risen, which has forced some species to migrate, end quote. So that's really, really deep heating down 700 meters below the surface of the ocean. We've known since March 2012 that the invasion of tall shrubs warms the soil, hence destabilizing permafrost, because the roots are higher temperature than freezing, obviously. Further elucidation of this phenomenon included study of 25 species, about 42,000 annual growth records from 1,800 individuals, as reported in the July 6, 2015 online issue of Nature Climate Change. And finally, from the journal literature, a paper published in the July 10th, 2015 issue of Science indicates a 1 to 2 degrees Celsius global average temperature rise has contributed to rapid sea level rise several times during the last 3 million years. I doubt this time will be different, and we're nearly at 1°C with 2°C guaranteed already. From beyond the referee journal literature come three stories. First, memos from the fossil fuel industry dating back nearly 35 years, quote, revealed decades of disinformation, a deliberate campaign to deceive the public that continues even today, end quote. That's according to an in-depth analysis from the Union of Concerned Scientists in July 2015. I'm thinking they should change their name to the Union of Really, Really Very Damn Concerned Scientists, but that's just me. Second, Gavin Schmidt increased his efforts to discredit the work of other scientists with comments in the August 2015 issue of Esquire. Yes, I said August 2015. I realize that's not here yet, but this issue of Esquire came out 3 or 4 days ago. Along the way, he demonstrated his lack of credibility with a single sentence, quote, there is no actual evidence that anything dramatically different is going on in the Arctic other than the fact that it's melting pretty much everywhere.
Oh, that's classic.
Nothing going on up here, folks. Look the other way. Oh, but it's melting pretty much everywhere.
Just ignore the water.
Jeez. Oh, my. It's the same amount of water, folks. It just is assuming a different form. Finally, the media have been guilty reporting and misquoting from a paper published late last week. They've been distorting the result. Gee, what a surprise. To conclude, Earth will enter a mini ice age between 2030 and 2040. I'd like to mention a few facts about that article that weren't pointed out when it came out. First of all, the clathrate gun has been fired. There's no way the proposed mini ice age will significantly slow the heating. Second, every report I've read about this study misquotes it. Solar magnetic activity was evaluated. Media reports are claiming solar intensity will decline. Those are completely different things. The anticipated 60% reduction in solar magnetic cycle magnitude, again, it's about the magnetic cycle, translates to a climate forcing of somewhere around negative one-tenth of a watt per meter squared. That's equivalent to a decrease of 8 parts per million atmospheric carbon dioxide. The atmosphere currently holds about 400 parts per million carbon dioxide, with 350 ultimately lethal to humans. Subtracting 8 parts per million at this point is analogous to adding blood to a dead man, and it's the wrong blood type, too. So that wraps my climate change update for this week. And if you think it's all bad news, well, you're absolutely right.
Add details, guy. Those aren't important. Wow, I didn't know you were going to have jokes in there, too. That's great.
If you can't cry, well, you know.
Wow, right. All right, folks. That about wraps it up for this week. Make sure to like us on our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like to address on the show, because we have an anniversary coming up. And please continue to follow Guy's blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We've also put out a survey. Is that right, Guy?
Yes, that's right. There's a survey just up at the blog and also on the two Facebook pages. So check into those. Fill out the survey.
Excellent. All right. We'll see you next time on the radio. If you miss us, make sure to find us next week and like us on iTunes. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
She bats last, and she's coming out swinging.